Great. Okay, so we're back after lunch. So I'm going to do a little bit of a loop within a loop here, really fast. So the question was, what about the ego? And what does this brain science stuff have to do with that? And then as I was fumbling to get my tape recorder going, I got some good suggestions, right, to repeat the question and to tape it. And what it reminded me of is a very interesting experience I had one time where we were in small groups in this training program, and we were learning about small groups. And one of the things that they did is they gave us this task, which was we were given a survival situation. Like, let's say a plane has crashed in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and on the plane, you know, are you and two other people, and there are a dozen objects, 12 different objects, and you have to rank order the objects in importance to survival. And some of them are obvious and some of them are not obvious at all. And then your score, your list is compared to the list of total experts on survival, let's say. And the way the exercise worked is that you did it individually initially, and so you created your list, and then that was set aside, and then you shared your list with everybody else in the group, and then you discussed what everybody thought would be the best possible group list. Okay? Two things were found out. One is that the main thing that was found out was that the group list was always better than the first draft of the best person's list. In other words, the group itself lifted the level of the best person. So I think that was a very humbling, and for me as a very independent kind of guy who knew a fair amount about survival already because of my background, that was impressive to really appreciate, you know, that we really are profoundly social animals, as we'll talk about later, right? And we really do, it really does take a village to raise a workshop. Anyway, self. Okay, I'm going to try to control myself here. So the question here is, what is the ego? Or more intimately, you know, what is the I? When you think, I want a cookie, or that's my book, or do you love me? That's the very intimate self here. The Buddha talked about this in two kinds of ways, and he sort of mixed together these two ideas of self. So it's, sometimes it's hard to tell what he's talking about, or it gets, there's some misunderstanding there. On the one hand, he talked about the self in terms of the Atman, this idea prevalent at the time in Hindu India, that there was a soul that did not arise due to conditions and was eternal. It was not created, it could not be destroyed, you know, it migrated from body to body, but it was like a pearl that was never compromised. And his argument, his view, was that there is no such soul. Whether he was right or wrong, in the words of the Buddha himself, ehi pasiko, see for yourself. But that was one argument. So that's where anatta came from, not Atman. Okay? Got that? He also talked about the psychological self, the I, me, or mine of I want a cookie, right? Or do you love me? And he made an argument there that undermined the notion that there is such an I. And he also pointed out the many ways in which the presumption of an I, a self in this sense, creates lots and lots of suffering and harm, in large part through the vehicles of identification and possessiveness. All right? So, okay. And this is a tricky topic, so I'm trying to work from one stone to another stone kind of carefully. So let's really consider whether or not there is a soul. I'm not qualified to judge. I don't know. I tend to give the Buddha the benefit of the doubt. Secretly, I hope there's an eternal soul. But let's set that aside metaphysically. Don't know. But the psychological self, very interesting. And you might like the last chapter in my book, which is about that, where neuroscience, I think, really does contribute. I wrote an essay recently called The Brain, So What? Because I think in a lot of places, brain science just muddies the waters, and people use it to glamorize themselves and sell books and stuff like that. I try not to do that. I try to think, where is it actually useful? You know, and this is an area where I think it is useful. So I'm going to do this fast because I do a whole day long on this topic. I love this idea of not self, because it's so deep, it's so fundamental. Really fast here, the notion in Western psychology and philosophy, and it's the ordinary notion, is that the I, the self, is the owner of experiences and the agent of actions. It's the one to whom things happen. Or in more detail, the self is unified, enduring across time, independent, and the essence of the person. All right? First, psychologically, you can see that those four characteristics are not true. First of all, the self is made up of many parts. There's the part that sets the alarm clock at night and says, we're going to exercise, that's great. Then there's the part of the self that wakes up in the morning and, who set the darn clock? Right? You know, we have different feelings, different selves. So there are different parts of us, different sub-personalities, different aspects. It's compounded. Two, it is not enduring. It actually keeps changing. Self or selfing, more exactly, continually changes. Which goes to the third aspect, it arises dependently. It's not independent. And finally, clearly, the sense of I, me, or mine is just part of the, it's just one more object of consciousness. It's one more object in awareness. It's not the totality of mind. I think this is where a distinction between self and person is very useful, which goes to the relationship practices we're about to go into. There's no question that you're a person, I'm a person, and you're a different person than I am, you know? We have different histories, we have different persons have moral duties, they also have moral rights, moral standing. Persons are existent. The question is whether the I, the me, the mine is existent, okay? Direct inspection in your own psychology is that these four characteristics of self do not exist. Self is compounded, it's not unified. Self is changing, it's not enduring, it doesn't have continuity over time. Third, self arises dependently, not independently. Fourth, self is not the essence of the being, it's just one more content of mind. The same thing, very powerfully, is found in neuroscience. For example, scans of the brain where people are activating different aspects of self, like they're remembering something, or they're picking out a photograph of themselves from a crowd, or they're making a difficult moral choice, all kinds of parts of the brain light up. There's no special place in the brain where self is. Self is compounded in the brain. And in fact, those places in the brain where selfing, representations of self, arise, are not special because they do all kinds of other things. In the streaming river of consciousness, in the stream of consciousness, selfing is just one more bunch of twigs and leaves. All right? It's just more flotsam and jetsam flowing through awareness, as far as the brain is concerned. It's not special. So in the brain, again, this thing we take as the unified, enduring owner of experiences and agent of action is widely distributed throughout the whole network of the brain. Second, it's not permanent. There's no little homunculus, little person looking out through the eyes. It's very changeable. It's like if we were to watch the sense of self, it would be lighting up here, then lighting up there, then getting quiet, expanded in the front, quiet in the back, big in the back, small in the front. It arises dependently as well in the brain. And it's just one content in the whole system. That's quite staggering to really face the implications of that. And what you can watch in your own practice is you can watch the ways in which strong pleasure or strong pain, the vednas, the feeling tone, pleasure and pain, strongly pleasant or strongly unpleasant, activate selfing. Because selfing is an adaptive function that developed in evolution to keep us alive. Right? So to see it in that way is useful. Here's the takeaway point. Think about a representation of a horse. Alright? Oh, in the brain, there are real representations of horses, right? You can think about a horse, you can imagine riding on a horse, you can think about being afraid of falling off a horse, right? those representations are real. Presumably there's a real neural substrate that supports them, although it's unclear exactly how that happens. There's a presumption, okay? They are representations of real things, okay? I think they're real horses. I don't know about you, but I think they're real horses. I think that whether if I died, if consciousness ended, I think there'd still be horses there. Okay. So we have real representations of a real thing. Selfing. We can represent the I. We can think there is an I. Okay? There can be real representations. But that which they point to is not real. In other words, representations of the I in the brain are like representations of a unicorn. Real, distinct from representations of a horse. Real representations of a mythical creature. And where this goes to practice is, for me, one, observing how selfing rises and falls. And how, notice how many times in the day you do something with no sense of self. Reach for the salt shaker. You know, someone nods or looks at you, you just kind of nod and look at them. No conscious control, no particular sense of self. Self is absent so much of the time we don't even notice it. You know, and then something happens that very typically triggers either strong pleasant or strong unpleasant, and then self starts constellating. It starts growing in the circuitry. You can watch it over a second or two or three if you're mindful. And then it's like a little child running after the parade that has already begun that says, look what I've created, right? But it is actually an afterthought, you know, that tries to claim it. The trick about self is to let it be just one more content of mind. The problem is not that selfing arises. The problem is that we identify with it and privilege it. We make self-representations special among all the representations in the mind. And that's where, to bring this more into relationships, because that's now where we're really going to go, okay? When we take things personally in relationships, we get upset, right? What's it like to take things personally? And nothing activates selfing like relationships. Right? You just walk down a street. You're kind of flowing and floating and, you know, there's not much sense of self. Let's say you're activating the lateral circuits, right? You're not lost in thought about yourself. Okay? You're just walking down the street and then you see someone step out of a shop that you know who says hello very quickly. You just watch. The construction of self starts to develop immediately right there. See? So, it's great to observe how selfing arises and falls away. And then that really takes you again and again, viscerally, in your direct experience, to not treating it so seriously. You know? I had a very, very powerful experience once, which has stayed with me, which is, it was so clear to me that so much is happening, you know, in the mind, in awareness, let alone outside of awareness. It's just not possible for any I, no matter how supercharged, you know, even Donald Trump's I, right? Even the mega I, the mega millionaire himself, even that I is not enough to control all of the stuff that's happening. Okay. All right, better move on. You wanted to say something about this. This gentleman had a question too. Did you?
I just wondered in terms of the recognition of the self. Is it one of the wolves that you feed or that you nourish, or you don't?
I think that's so beautifully. I never thought of that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's true. The Buddha has, so their question was, is self like a wolf, right, that you feed? The Buddha had this lovely wordy term he used constantly, nutriment. Sounds like a fancy word. It's just food, you know? So it's exactly right. Do we feed the weeds or do we feed the flowers? Do we feed the wolf of hate or the wolf of love? Do we feed the self or do we feed the person? All right? And I think if we feed the I, that's problematic. The trick, which we're in deep water here. Somehow I'm doing the workshop on anatta, but the art, it's a funny thing where sometimes what we have to do is take in self-supplies, like narcissistic supplies, that's the term in psychology, like being praised or appreciated or loved. We have to take in self-supplies to feed the self enough to calm it down so we can transcend the self. Somebody, a psychologist wrote, he was a Buddhist psychoanalyst, he said, you have to be somebody in order to become nobody, right? And so that's part of the art. The trick, though, is to take in the good, take in those supplies without getting addicted to them, and taking them with clear intention that you're trying to fill that hole so you can move on. Because if we don't get enough normal, healthy, narcissistic supplies growing up, and also in adulthood, that leaves a hole in our heart. And around that hole, there's a lot of self-activation that either wants those supplies, gimme, 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 gimme. In the extreme, you have borderline personality disorder, right? Which is like, feed me, you suck, feed me, you suck. You know, that's, okay? All right? Clinging and burning, all right? And I have compassion for that. That comes from not having enough. Or alternately, you have people who are like very defended. Yeah, I'm fine. You know? It's like a great book about male depression. I just don't want to talk about it. But there's so much self there. So it's that hole in the heart. So paradoxically, part of the way to help ourselves move beyond self is to take in those kind of nurturing supplies. Okay. One more person, then we're moving on.
Concerning the children.
Because I'm going to talk about ways of supporting personhood in a moment and why it's really important to take care of our personhood, because that's a foundation for being able to be loving and strong with others. Because if we don't have a strong, if we haven't fed the person over here, it's hard to take care of them over there or straighten them out over there, both of which are important. Okay, thank you. Yeah, the children?
Some children that don't receive protection, care, yeah. Love, right. And some say that if you don't receive these items when you're a child, well, your brain cannot evolve or develop. So, well, these children are prone to be less happy in life.
Okay, so the question is, what about, in formal language, early attachment issues? In other words, what about children who, and I was just going to say, some of whom are in this room as adults, you know, what about people who, as young children, did not receive good nurturing care? Now, first of all, there is a range of that. And second, there's a degree of vulnerability of the child. Some children are particularly sensitive, and they're also particularly aware of relationship supplies, so they are especially vulnerable to problems in attachment. Whereas other children come out, and they're maybe more introverted, or more resilient, or you know, physically healthy, who knows, and they can put up with more bad treatment. So what you really want to think about is the fit, the combination. That's important. Okay. Now, there is some research about extreme mistreatment that suggests that there are critical periods in early development, typically the first year and a half to 3 years of life, even younger, like 6 to 9 months. They're critical periods where if a child is treated extremely badly, that brain is permanently damaged. But let's be clear about this. First, we're talking about extreme mistreatment or extreme deprivation, like these really horrible cases that are very rare you read about where someone is raised in a closet or the basement for the first 6 years of their life before they're finally discovered, and no one ever talks to them. Yes, I suspect that because certain parts of the brain develop at certain times, like in the first 18 months, the right hemisphere develops ahead of the left hemisphere. It's not that the left hemisphere is asleep, but it's not quite as developing. And that makes sense because the right hemisphere is where we apprehend threats, because the threats usually come from the surround. So it makes sense to develop the capacity to be aware, you know, of the surround, right? And so if, for example, there is real radical mistreatment during that age, you can impair that capacity later. Okay. On the other hand, I think that some of the research on real extremes of deprivation gets overgeneralized to people who just had a bad childhood, just had the usual crummy, rotten childhood. And I'm not trivializing the usual crummy, rotten childhood, but, you know, it was just your usual crummy, rotten childhood. They're injured, maybe, but I don't think they're permanently damaged by it. And this is where the kind of information that we're talking about here, and I also think a growing amount of research shows, that the reparative capacity of the brain, or to use a different kind of language, the reparative capacity of the human spirit and heart is nearly infinite. Nearly infinite. And what I see people often don't do, honestly, is they don't work that hard at it. That's the real question. You know, I think the real question is, if people work as hard at their healing as they do at their golf game, or learning Windows 7 or 77, whatever it is now. I'm a Mac guy, you know, in California anyway. Sorry about that. But just imagine how good it would be. I see this all the time. I see people who work really hard at things that don't really matter that much even to them, and they're not willing to work that hard at things that matter a lot to them, like raising their children skillfully, or being a skillful partner in a relationship, or becoming more and more skillful with their own thoughts and feelings, which really matter much more to them. So I think we don't know. What the possibilities are if people sustain skillful effort over long periods of time. I'm very hopeful there. Now that said, and this will lead right into a practice, to do that, you've got to be on your own side. You have to be for yourself, right? Your own life has to matter. And as a therapist, one of the things that surprised me early on was, like, my client's suffering mattered more to me than it mattered to them. And that was strange. You know, and it wasn't that I was so, I mean, I'm a nice guy, but it was that they didn't matter at all. You know, or as I joked to my wife one time, I said, honey, I don't care about how I feel. Why would I care about how you feel? So, anyway, that was an extreme joke. I'm sorry. I don't know how funny that was. But it's kind of like that. If there's a certain stoicism, I mean, and people can have that in the extreme, where they just, it doesn't matter to themselves, their own suffering. So if your suffering doesn't matter to you, why will you do anything to change it, right? And so maybe we could use that as a segue for a particular practice I'd like to do, if that's all right. I work with children. I have deep, deep feeling for them. The first book I wrote was about how to take really good care of mothers, because that's the best possible way to take really good care of kids. And the best way to take care of mothers, the factor that has the biggest effect on that, is to promote a strong relationship with her partner. You know, isn't that interesting? You could change this world in a generation if we made the care of mothers the number one public health priority. You know, we would turn this planet around. Highly leveraged. It's like in third world countries, the best way to change them, that most highly leveraged way, where the least intervention will have the biggest result, is to educate girls. Yeah. You know, that's a very powerful finding. So, anyway, I digress. So, you want to do a practice?
Yeah.
And if you find yourself, I'm sorry to do this. This is not a hypnotic suggestion. Ignore, you know, it's like disregard the following. So, if you start feeling sleepy, stand up. Okay, but you won't, right? Because you're going to really energize yourself. All right. So here we go. Let's try a practice around compassion for yourself and feeling strong and being on your own side, which then will be the basis for the other practices we'll do about relationships. All right? Okay, great. So come to a place of centeredness. So first, bring to mind, if you can, a time when you felt really strong. Maybe it had to do with something physical, like a hard workout or a long run or a big hike. Or maybe a time when you really stood up for someone you loved. Or a time you stood up for yourself. So see if you can call to mind that experience and let it really grow and fill you right now. maybe, if you like, through embodied cognition, shift your posture a little bit to a feeling of strength. Maybe sitting up straighter, maybe the chest coming out, maybe a sense of resolve in your face. Nothing phony, nothing extreme. Just abiding in the sense of strength. Maybe a sense of mental toughness. Being resolute, determined. And then as you can, grounding increasingly in the felt sense of strength, explore what happens if you become also aware of other people around you. And see if you can find a place of remaining strong in yourself while also being aware of others and even feeling increasingly connected, perhaps to the people sitting nearby you right now. If it's hard to feel strong while also feeling connected, just go back to feeling strong. And after you've recentered in strength, experiment with and explore again feeling connected while also feeling strong. To take it one step further, staying grounded in the simple feeling of strength, with your gaze downward, open your eyes to become visually aware of bodies nearby you. Even if you like beginning to move your head from side to side, not making eye contact, being aware of bodies nearby you, a more palpable sense of connection, while continuing to keep feeding the sense of inner strength. So explore that now with your eyes open, not making eye contact, but feeling strong as you visually are aware of others around you. You might experiment with the sense of being like a very, very strong tree with deep roots, and the energies of other people pass through you like wind through the leaves of a tree. Maybe rattling the tree a little bit from time to time, but fundamentally the tree stays sturdy, deeply rooted, and strong. Now, staying grounded in a sense of strength, even if it slips a little bit into the background of awareness, as we've done a few times already, bring to mind the felt sense of being with someone who cares about you. And if you like, you can let your eyes close again if that helps. You're bringing up the sense of being cared about. That someone, let's say, has compassion for you, wishes that you not suffer, or also that they wish you to be happy, they have kindness for you. And you're feeling cared about as a result. Then bring to mind someone that it's naturally for you to care about, it's natural for you to care about or have compassion for. A friend, a pet, a child. And open up to and encourage the feeling of compassion, which is simply the wish that a being not suffer, combined with an emotion of tender concern. Be mindful of compassion. What's it feel like as you sink into it and it sinks into you? You might put your hand on your heart or your hand on your cheek if that helps you deepen in the feeling of compassion. Now, knowing what compassion feels like, opening to it, letting it be present, imagine yourself as a young child and see if you can extend compassion to that young version of you. A little kid, vulnerable, innocent. Bumping into things, feeling pain and hurt, confusion, anger. Explore a sense of compassion for that young version of you. If compassion crumbles and is replaced by judgments or anger or numbness, it's okay. See if you can reestablish the sense of compassion itself. Maybe for someone else, and then see if you can bring it back to the younger layers of you inside yourself and also the younger version of yourself way back in time. All right. And then to take it a step further, see if you can keep bringing compassion to the younger version of yourself as she gets older, or as he gets older. Moving through, let's say, the elementary school years up to age 12 or so. Taking a minute to maybe touch on some major events in your young life that warrant compassion. Staying focused on the compassion, not getting hijacked by the pain of that little kid. And now continuing to extend compassion and caring yourself through the teenage years, the ups and downs of that time, wishing that young person well, maybe even sensing that somehow that younger version of you, those layers deep down in your own psyche today, are actually receiving this care and good wishes and nurturance and compassion that you're offering to yourself through the teenage years. Then continuing on through the 20s, and if that's as far as your life has gone, that's fine. Just keep enjoying it. Compassion for yourself going through maybe some major transitions, going off to school or starting your first real jobs, maybe leaving home. Maybe some major experiences of heartbreak, relationship ups and downs. Keep offering love, offering compassion to the younger you in his or her 20s. And then taking another minute or so up to the present time, your current age, kind of having the movie of your life move quickly, not getting overwhelmed by the movie, continually returning to compassion itself, but maybe thinking through some of the major events of your life after your 20s, if you've had an after your 20s. big challenges, perhaps, big difficulties, big ups and downs. Can you keep extending compassion to yourself, aging, moving forward in time, up to the present day? And then bringing it into the present moment, feeling compassion for yourself, just here and now. Even compassion, if your life is going well, for just the inherent dukkha, suffering, the subtle strain or tension or longing or unsatisfactoriness of animal existence. Simply compassion, just for that alone, right now. And then moving forward in time, imagine yourself living into the future for the rest of this year. And imagine maybe some difficulties or challenges or ongoing difficulties, pain in the body, illness, issues with family members, aging parents, children, loved ones, the world. And see if you can have compassion for your future self going forward in time through the remainder of this year. And then keep extending that compassion to your future self as he or she keeps aging. Like, for example, all the way through the end of 2011. Thinking maybe about challenges to come or inevitable transitions, the death of loved ones, ups and downs. Compassion for your future self. Keep feeling as well amidst this compassion and caring, a sense of being for yourself, that your life matters, your experience of living matters, you wish yourself well. What's the feeling of wishing yourself well, of being for yourself, the feeling of being on your own side? And then imagine the movie speeding up some as you move forward to the last year of your life. And all the while, sending yourself good wishes, compassion and caring as your life unfolds forward to the last year of your life. Imagine a long life and a good one, a relatively healthy and happy last year of life, imagining the realistically best possible outcomes, which still have lots to be compassionate about. And then imagine your life moving forward to the last days, the final few days of your life, sending compassion to that sweet person, the one you know better than any other, your own future self. Wishing her well, wishing him well, and the final challenges of the last days of your life. Moving forward to the last few hours of your life, extending compassion and care to your future self. Staying with it. And then moving toward the last few minutes, the last few breaths that every life, including my own, will have. Wishing that person well as she faces her own death, his own death. Sending love and care up to the last minute, the last breath. For all of us, there will one day be a last breath. Can you send kindness, care, and respect to yourself, facing your last breath? Compassion and caring up to the moment of death. And perhaps through the moment of death and mysteriously beyond. Whatever that unfolding is, wishing the person you know better than any other the very best as he or she passes on. Could you move that projector? Is a little funky right now. Oh, good. Okay. Could you scroll forward? There's a quote from Pema Chodron that's coming. If you just move forward to that. Yes. Wonderful. So, one thing to do is, as you can, keep staying with the emotional memory of what being on your own side feels like, you know, being for yourself, being caring toward yourself. What's that really like? So how was that practice for you? That's a very deep practice, isn't it? You know, I always feel very grateful that people will let me take them through that. It's always a risk. You know, what will happen when people go toward the end of the lifespan. So, how was that? What was that like for you?
It was bittersweet. It was bittersweet. I don't know if to smile or to cry. Or
yeah. Bittersweet, she said. Bittersweet. Yeah.
Yeah. And the sense of, I've been there before, I've thought of all of this, right? But the universality of the experience, and millions throughout the ages.
It reminds me of that Tibetan monk, you know, in a way, what you're saying. She was talking about the universality of facing death, and his comment that when he was, the only time he was afraid that he was losing his true life was when he felt like he might be losing his loving kindness. And I think even if the body dies, if we can sustain our compassion and good wishes for ourselves and others, you know, we sustain the true life in a sense. Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to apologize for giggling when the glass broke at the last breath. I'm sorry, I hope it didn't take away from it.
It was all right. It was okay.
Somehow humorous to me.
Yeah. Okay.
I found the process illuminating, and it was surprising with the episodes, the sequence of events, what presented. And ultimately, it was reassuring.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Maybe one or two more? Yeah.
This is clearly a practice I could never do on my own.
Yeah.
Because it would freak me out.
Yeah.
And doing it under guidance and doing it with other people, to me, is the only way that I can go through that.
Yeah.
It was really marvelous to do it. And I think leading from childhood to old age is very reassuring, because it's this child inside of us that we're trying to keep safe all the way to the end.
Yeah.
Because it's still that child at the very end, which is really scary.
Yeah, that's so beautifully said. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, please.
I want to ask if it's any relationship between the feeling strong, be able to have compassion.
His question,
because,
yeah.
The first time when I introduced us to feel strong, the only moment that I feel strong come in my mind was when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And with this in my mind, when it comes to compassion, it's the first time I feel real compassion.
Oh, that's great. His experience was that when he was able to access a memory, a body memory, an emotional memory, of feeling strong at a time around age 13 and 14, somehow that opened a doorway for him to feel compassion in a way he never had before, right? Is that accurate? Thank you. And then the question is there a relationship between the two? I've seen studies about how taking in the sense of being cared about primes the mind and therefore the brain to be more caring about others, which is why I do it in that way. Because for many people, being compassionate for themselves is quite hard. So I start by having you begin with the felt sense of being cared about by others, and then extend compassion to someone that's easy to extend compassion for, and then only then move to compassion for oneself, which is actually hard for many people. So there is research about that. But as I said, I've never seen research about strength and compassion. On the other hand, it makes sense to me somehow, because unless a person is a saint, and I'm not, having our own cup full, including with the sense of strength, is really useful in terms of being more giving to other people. Lots of research has shown that for the typical person, me included, the more that they feel filled up, happy, and loved, the more likely they are to be pro-social toward others. More generous, more patient, more forbearing, more giving, and so forth. So that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. Okay, maybe one more. Thank you, and then we'll move on. That's beautiful.
It was a surprise.
The experience there, if I get it right, of the experience of if you're on your own side, you're never alone. In a nutshell, yeah. And I'm also glad that we did not get into any big philosophical questions here about who is the I that wonders if there's a no I. You know, that's good. But we know what we're talking about. Yeah, that's, I think, for me, a way to think about that is to appreciate that it's a jungle up here. Mm-hmm. And the person is the whole ecosystem. And it has many, there's a lovely quote from Ajahn Chah, who's the main teacher in the kind of Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield lineage, where he talks about as the mind gets quiet, it's like sitting by a still mountain pool. And at that pool, all kinds of marvelous and beautiful and strange creatures will come. I think he's partly talking about it, the mind, not just literally creatures. And as he says, you will know the peace of the Buddha. And I think there's something about that, becoming more and more comfortable with the inner ecosystem, the inner jungle. We cannot kill the wolf of hate. The attempt to kill the wolf of hate feeds the wolf of hate. In spiritual circles, sometimes people are ashamed of their own aggressiveness, or they deny it. And yes, we need to contain it and manage it. The Buddha spent a lot of, he focused more on aversion than he did on greed, if you think about it. There's more, for example, in wise intention, has three elements to it. You know, wise intention is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's one of the eight elements, you know, of practice, wise intention. It's the intention of non-harming, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of renunciation. The first two are about dealing with aversion, dealing with the wolf of hate, dealing with the threat response system, the avoid system, rather than only one. I was going to put up this finger, but I thought that would be impolite. Only one that has to do with the approaching system, which is the greed system. You know, so isn't that interesting? I mean, he put a lot of emphasis on dealing with that member of the inner jungle. We can't kill it, but we do need to manage it. But trying to kill it just gives it more food. Okay. So, let's keep going and stay, you know, it's okay to keep staying with whatever you've gotten from doing these practices, continuing to let them sink in with you, to you. It's natural if other emotions arise like sorrow or grief, it's really okay. See if you can hold that salt, quote unquote, in a wide space, you know, of mindfulness and feeling cared about by other people. Okay, so some slides here. Hang on 1 second. I want to make sure where I am. Yes. How about moving forward through like two? Oh, keep going. Where are we? Keep going. Okay, you will want how virtue supports relationships. Yay. Okay. So to deal with relationships, one of the things that I think is useful to address to honor, and then we'll keep going, is the whole idea of virtue. And in Buddhism, virtue is seen as something that's very important from a practical standpoint in terms of supporting relationships, which then gave us the Buddhist relationship virtues, which is the next slide. Great. So I went through the Dharma and I looked for the Buddha's advice about relationships, his concrete, specific advice, right? And this is pretty much what I was able to find. If anyone here has, you know, something substantially additional to this, that would be great. But if you think about it, as the first line says, these are aspirations. These are not so much, you know, commandments that it's a sin to break. These are seen as practical advice. But they're really quite simple. One is the five precepts, okay? We don't kill others. We don't steal from them. We don't abuse them sexually. We don't lie to them. And we don't get intoxicated and, you know, break the china. Okay? Okay? That's pretty straightforward. Then we have the right speech precepts, the one underneath wise livelihood. Livelihood, it also bears on people. We don't take people in slavery. We don't produce weapons. We don't poison them. Okay? The Buddha, you know, even though by all accounts he probably ate meat, it's unclear, but he probably did, he didn't trade in it. Right? He didn't directly cause the death of animals. Okay? And then we have the wise speech virtues. These are very interesting. Basically, the Buddha said, you always want to do five things, and if possible, a sixth. So what are the essence of wise speech? Now we're getting into relationships. We want to be well-intended. We want to say what's true, what's beneficial, what's timely, and what's not harsh. And ideally, what's wanted. That's not always so easy to do. That's good advice. I find myself thinking a fair amount about this, especially the one about harsh, because tone really matters. Because we're social animals, we're very attentive to threat, we're very attentive to tone. Tone really, really matters. And getting more skillful about tone, not being a doormat, not walking on eggshells, but being more conscious of tone, more aware of tone, and using tone more carefully. I'm quite struck by the experience of being in a restaurant where, let's say it's a noisy restaurant, everyone's talking away. As soon as you hear an angry voice, what happens? Everybody gets quiet. Because it's a threat signal, what's going to happen here. Research on primate bands, you know, chimpanzees, gorillas, close relatives. When they communicate with each other, all kinds of communications are being offered, and they pick them up, they tune into them, and so forth. As soon as any expression of anger is communicated in the primate band, everybody pays attention to that, because that is salient. That tone really captures attention. Tone really matters. Okay? And then I want to introduce a notion of unilateral virtue, and then we'll do a practice. So the next slide. Great. So by unilateral virtue, I mean what the Buddha meant, which was no matter what other people do to you, live by your own code. There's a famous sutta that has a section in it called the Simile of the Saw, where some monks came back and said they'd gone for alms in a neighboring village, and people insulted them and yelled at them and called them names and, you know, nanny nanny foo foo, you know, your robe is a poo poo or something, whatever, you know? And they were upset. So they came back, told the Buddha, they called us names, and he said, look, essentially to paraphrase him, he said, if people insult you, anyone who loses the mind of loving kindness when others insult him or her, is not practicing my way. Even further, anyone who is pushed or grabbed or held or shoved by others and loses a mind of loving kindness is not practicing my way. Even to the extreme, this is the extreme, anyone whose limbs are being sawed off by bandits and who loses a mind of loving kindness for those bandits is not practicing my way. Wow. You know, that's the monk in jail standard, you know, but still. Now, the Buddha was willing to be very assertive. I love these little these suttas where, you know, the line, "Oh, foolish man." I don't know if he ever said, "Oh, foolish woman." I don't know. There were a number of women who were very far in practice, including arahants. But in any case, he said, "Oh, foolish man." I just think it's kind of interesting. There's also the famous Rahula Sutta, where Rahula is his son. And his son's probably around 10 or 12 at the time, and the Buddha's giving Rahula advice. And I think sometimes, how heavy that must have been. Your dad, the Buddha, is laying some, he's bringing that law down on you, you know. And he basically said to Rahula, "What's good advice though, right?" Although I can't help but put myself in the place of Rahula. A guy probably identify more with Rahula, you know, the inner kid, than the Buddha. But anyway, maybe I should work on that. But he said, "Rahula, you know, before you do anything, ask yourself, will it help yourself and others or harm yourself and others? And if it'll help yourself and others, it's okay to do it. While doing anything, ask yourself, is this helping myself and others or is it harming myself and others? If it's helping, keep doing it. If it's harming, stop it. And after you do something, ask yourself, is this helping others or harming myself and others? If it helped you and others, good. If it harmed you or others, go tell somebody about it." You know, be straight about it, learn the lesson and move on, okay? And I thought to myself, you know, no wonder monks don't, or nuns, are often very quiet. Because if you're doing all that, you're going to walk slowly and say very little, right? Because you're going to be reviewing. But it's good advice, isn't it? That's the Buddha's advice to Rahula. Okay. So these are these virtues, so-called. The question is, what about doing them no matter what? Now, I don't mean not, you know, I don't mean just putting up with mistreatment. I just mean staying within the lines, staying within the rules, if you will, whatever your personal code is, no matter what other people are doing. For me, this has been one of the most powerful practices in my personal relationships. It's the idea that no matter what they're doing, I'm orienting around what I think is ethical, skillful, has integrity, is an expression of my natural state, etc., to do, no matter what they're doing. So that increasingly, and this is again, I think, very close to the Buddha's teaching, that our own conduct is increasingly unconditional. It's not based on conditions. I see couples a lot where they basically say to each other, "I'll treat you well if you treat me well." And then the other person says, "Well, I'll treat you well if you start treating me well, you first." And then, bam, it's a standoff. And you see that writ large in many places around the world, you know, larger organizations or nations, right? So I think the alternative has a kind of inner freedom to it, where we operate by our own code no matter what. An expression of that I see often in couples that I talk about is the 80-20 rule, where the typical couple basically is focused, you know, when they're in trouble, 80 to 90% on what's wrong with the other person, maybe 100% on their case about the other person, and very little about their own contribution to the mess. That's okay, that's understandable, that's where we start, that's where we begin. But it doesn't work to stay there. What works is to shift into a different mode, where sure, put 20% of your attention on what you want from the other person, what would make things go better. But after you've made your communication, shift over to what's the maximum reasonable responsibility you can take for your part of the matter, and do that. And complaint by complaint by complaint, keep lining out the complaints of the other party to the maximum reasonable extent. That's my personal observation. That's what I've, you know, I've just seen that work. It's really hard to stay mad at somebody who operates that way, right? And after you do operate that way for a while, where does that put you? On the moral high ground, right? Unilateral virtue is the best odds strategy to elicit good behavior from others. It also feels good in its own right. And like I said, it puts you on the moral high ground. Because you can then say, look, you got to admit it. The last few days, certainly the last few, even the last few weeks, I've done this, 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 and this, right? You got to admit it. Well, you know, it would be great if you did that, that, and that. That's the idea of unilateral virtue. So how about we do a little practice here with writing or just thinking? It's not a guided practice. And then we'll talk about it, all right? So ask yourself, what are your personal code of virtues? So maybe we could go back to the previous slide that has the Buddha's advice, right, for the Buddhist relationship virtues. Good. So in your mind, And it especially helps to do this if you imagine, what's the most upsetting relationship in your life these days? Let's go there. All right? Right after. Jugular. Right at it. I'm a therapist. I'm sorry. Right at it. Let's lance that boil. Okay. And ask yourself, in that mess, you know, where you're probably getting triggered, you're being upset, you're probably being mistreated. Bad things are probably, could well be happening. They're not in your mind. They're real. They're real tigers sometimes. Okay? It's the real thing. In the most upsetting relationship in your life, what is your personal code? What are the virtues you want to live by? They might include speaking truth to power, not being cowed, not being pushed around. It might include reaching out for allies and support, because sometimes we have this grandiose thought that we can deal with our oppressors by ourselves, or that it's somehow wimpy to get, you know, allies. Allies are so important, including, if only, to bear witness to what's happened and to see it and acknowledge it. As a little detail, there's a structure in the mind, and you see it in relationships a lot, that was originally described as the inner child, then the nurturing parent, and the critical parent. That's transactional analysis. More of an updated version of that comes from trauma work, where people talk about the victim, the persecutor, and the protector. Now, interestingly, where's most of the psychological action, typically? It's not with the persecutor. It's with the failed protector. It's with the person who should have stepped in but didn't. Right? Isn't that interesting? Not always, but very often, because people kind of go, oh, I know, I'm going to use a bad word in a minute here. You know, I know that persecutor. I know that person who mistreats me. He, she, it. They're assholes. I know what they are. I get that. But you, you're on my side. You're my mother. You're my father. You're my family member. You're my brother. You're my boss. You're my friend. You're my teacher. Why didn't you help me? Why didn't you at least call a spade, and name what was really going down? Right? Isn't that true? That's often, those are the person we really are mad at. And so, 2 points. One, it's really important to take in the felt sense of being cared about by real protectors and by asking for support and addressing people about not being willing to do the hard thing. And on the other side of it, going to your comment as well, when we're around people that are not being treated right, doing what we can to speak up about it. You know, if nothing else, bearing witness to what was being done. That's why I think it's so powerful in some of the countries that are going through a reconciliation process, like they did in South Africa or they're starting to do in Rwanda, to bear witness to what happened. I see it. You know, I see you. It's like the Buddha said, his night of awakening, I see you, Mara. Just the recognition of the evil or the misdeeds is itself a powerful contribution. Okay. So, virtues may include sticking up for others. It might include your own personal list, not speaking or acting out of anger. That's an extreme virtue, but it's worth thinking about. I actually took that as a kind of vow, never to speak or act out of anger, especially with my kids. And I'm very kind of mellow, and I really got, no, I was not a raging kind of got dad, you know, bad dad, nothing like that. But when I did this, and it was probably, I don't remember, kind of foggy on time, about 8 years ago probably, the first day I did it, I probably broke that vow 20 times in little ways, you know, like the eye roll or the sniff, right? Or that little dad-like tone, Forrest, right? That's my son's name. Or, you know, that resort to being right. Well, you really didn't do that, you know. There's a place, there's a place for anger. You know, anger energizes us. It's a place to know it. I'm not trying to sit here and say, don't be angry with people. But I want to nominate for you, much as the Buddha did in that sutta, that you really think about not acting out of anger. What happened for me when I took that kind of precept, which mostly now is very centered in me, is that it made me a better dad. Probably made me a better person too, in that it forced me to slow down. It also forced me to look past the anger to what's usually underneath it, which is hurt or fear. And it forced me to speak more from my heart, which actually often has the best Dodd strategy of having a real impact on other people. When we sputter at people, or rant at people, or nag people out of anger, what usually happens? Row, row, row the boat, jet. You know what I mean? Or their own version of, screw you, screw you. You got my body, you're never gonna get my mind. Screw you, screw you. You know? All right. How many of you have ever raised teenagers? I don't know. Don't even raise it. No, there's that. Okay? Whereas on the other hand, if you maintain this place of dignity and groundedness and strength and being on your own side and a sense of the truth of what you're saying and the gravity of it all and speak from the heart in a way that's not excessive, not inflammatory, that can often be very, very powerful, can it not? And there are many examples as well in history of people who sustained that stance, right, in the face of horrible provocation. Think about Nelson Mandela, right, Mahatma Gandhi in America, Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., obviously today the Dalai Lama, many other examples, known and unknown, right, many quiet heroes we don't know about who've done amazing things. They often had that example of this kind of grounded, dignified, absolutely serious strength. I think of how Thich Nhat Hanh, you probably know, is described by Baker Roshi, who's a Zen teacher, as Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, the Vietnamese monk, peace advocate, and so forth, living mainly in France, very prolific writer as well, deep, deep Dharma teacher. He was described as a combination of cloud, butterfly, and bulldozer. Okay, so what's your code? Think about, okay, in this most upsetting, most aggravating, most difficult, challenging relationship, what's my personal code that I want to commit to living by no matter what they do? Not conditioned on what they do or don't do. What is your code? So we'll take about 2 more minutes, 3 maybe, on this. And then we'll do a little practice about it.